I mean, at JPL, we had an issue adding a leap second to our system planning software, and that was a fully coordinated many months of planning for 1 second. Because when you're traveling at 15,000 miles per hour, 1 second off in your guidance algorithms means you miss the planet, right? So we were very careful. Yeah, our navigation parameters had like 15 decimal places. It was crazy.
Welcome to Break Things on Purpose, a podcast about reliability, building things with purpose, and embracing learning. In this episode, we talk to Dan Isla, VP of Product at Itopia, about the importance of reliability, astronomical units, and time zones on Mars.
Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Jason and Julie.
Awesome. Also, yeah, Julie is here.
Yeah. Hi, Dan.
Julie's having internet latency issues. I swear we are not running a gremlin latency attack on her, although she might be running one on herself. Have you checked in the gremlin control panel?
You know, let me go ahead and do that while you two talk. But no, hi, and I hope it's not too problematic here, but I'm really excited to have Dan with us here today because Dan is a Boise native, which is where I'm from as well. So Dan, thanks for being here and chatting with us today about all the things.
You're very welcome. It's great to be here to chat on the podcast.
So Dan has mentioned working at a few places, and I think they're all fascinating and interesting, but probably the most fascinating, being a science and technology nerd, Dan, you worked at JPL.
I did. I was at the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California, right after graduating from Boise State from 2009 to around 2017. So it was quite the adventure. Got to work on some literally out of this world projects. And it was like drinking from a fire hose, being kind of fresh out to some degree. I was an intern before that, so I had some experience, but working on a Mars rover mission was kind of my primary task, and the Mars rover Curiosity was what I worked on as a systems engineer and a flight software test engineer, doing launch operations, surface operations, pretty much the whole like life cycle of the spacecraft I got to experience. And had some long days and some problems we had to solve, and it was a lot of fun. I learned a lot at JPL, a lot about how government like agencies are run, a lot about how spacecraft are built, and then towards the end, a lot about how you can modernize systems with cloud computing. That led to my exit from there.
I'm curious if you could dive into that, the modernization, right? Because I think that's fascinating. When I went to college, I initially thought I was going to be an aerospace engineer. And so because of that, they were like, by the way, you should learn Fortran because everything's written in Fortran and nothing gets updated, which I was a little bit dubious about. So correct folks that are potentially looking into jobs in engineering with NASA, is it all Fortran or what do things look like?
That's an interesting observation. Believe it or not, Fortran is still used. Fortran 77 and Fortran was it 95, but it's mostly in the science community. So a lot of data processing algorithms and things for actually computing science written by PhDs and postdocs is still in use today, mostly because those were algorithms that like people built their entire dissertation around. And to change them added so much risk to the integrity of the science, even just changing the language where you go to a language with different levels of precision or computing repeatability. Introduce risk to the integrity of the science. So we just like reuse the same algorithms for decades. It was pretty amazing. Yeah.
So you mentioned modernizing then. How do you modernize with systems like that? Do you just take that code base, stuff it in a VM or a container and pretend it's okay?
Yeah. So a lot of it is done very carefully. It goes kind of beyond the language down to even some of the hardware that you run on. You know, hardware computing has, you know, different endianness, which means the order of bits in your data structures. as well as different levels of precision, whether it's a RISC system or an AMD 64 system. And so just putting the software in a container and making it run wasn't enough. You had to actually compute it, compare it against the study that was done and the papers that were written on it to make sure you got the same result. So it was pretty, we had to be very careful when we were containerizing some of these applications and the software.
You know, Dan, one thing that I remember from one of the very first talks I heard of yours back in, I think, 2015, was you actually talked about how we say within DevOps, embrace failure and embrace risk. But when you are talking about space travel, that becomes something that has a completely different connotation. And I'm kind of curious, like, how do you work around that?
Yeah, so failing fast is not really an option when you only have one thing that you have built or can build. And so, yeah, there's definitely a lot of adverseness to failing. And what happens is it becomes a focus on testing, stress testing. We call it robustness testing, and being able to observe failures and automate repairs. So one of the test programs I was involved with at JPL was during the descent part of the rover's approach to Mars. There was a powered descent phase where the rover actually had a rocket-propelled jetpack and it would descend to the surface autonomously and deliver the rover to the surface. And during that phase, it's moving so fast that we couldn't actually remote control it. So it had to do everything by itself. And there were two flight computers that were online, pretty much redundant everything hardware-wise. And so it's kind of up to the software to recover itself. And so that's called entry, descent, and landing. And one of my jobs towards the end of the development phase was to ensure that we tested all of the possible breakage points. So we would do kind of evil gremlin-like things. The people in the test bed, we were actually called gremlins. And they inject faults during the simulation. So we had copies of the hardware running on a desk. The software was running. And then we'd have gremlins go and say, like, hey, flight computer one just went out. You know, what's going to happen? And you watch the software kind of take over and either do the right thing or simulate a crash landing. And we find bugs in the software this way. We'd find like hangs in the control loops for recovery. And we had to fix those before we made it to Mars, just in case that ever happened. So that was like how we like really stress test the hardware. We did the same thing with situational awareness and operations. We had to simulate things that would happen like during launch or during the transit from Earth to Mars, and then see how the team itself reacted to those. You know, do our playbooks work? Can we run these in enough time and recover the spacecraft? So it was a lot of fun. I guess that's about as close to like actually breaking something I can claim to.
Well, I have to say, you've done a good job because according to Wikipedia, which we all know is a very reliable source, as of May 9th, 2022, Curiosity has been active on Mars for 3,468 souls or 3,563 days and is still active, which is really amazing because was it ever intended to actually be operational that long?
Not really. The hardware was built to last for a very long time. But, you know, as with most missions that are funded, they only have a certain amount of number of years that they can be operated to fund the team, to fund the development and all that. And so the prime mission was only like 2 years. And so it just keeps getting extended. As long as the spacecraft is healthy and like doing science and showing results, we usually extend the missions until they just fall apart or die or be intentionally decommissioned, kind of like the Cassini project. But yeah.
Well, you've heard it here first, folks. In order to keep funding, you just need to be, quote, doing science. But Dan, after JPL, that's when you went over to Google, right?
Yeah. So kind of that transition from learning how to modernize with cloud. I've been doing a lot with data, a lot with, you know, Amazon's government cloud, which is the only cloud we could use at JPL, and falling in love with these APIs and ways to work with data that were not possible before, and saw this as a great way to you know, move the needle forward in terms of modernization. Cloud is a safe place to prototype, a safe place to get things done quick. And I always wanted to work for a big tech company as well. So that was always another thing I was itching to scratch. And so Google, I interviewed there and finally made it in. It was not easy. I definitely failed my first interview, but then tried again a few years later. And I came in as a cloud solution architect. to you know, help customers adopt cloud more quickly, get through roadblocks. My old manager used to say the solution architects were the Navy SEALs of cloud. They would drop in, drop a bunch of knowledge bombs, and then like get out and go to the next customer. It was a lot of fun. I got to build some cool technology, and I learned a lot about what it's like working in a big public company.
Well, one of my favorite resources is the Google SRE book, which, as much as I talk about it, I'm just going to admit it here now to everybody that I have not read the entire thing.
It's okay.
Okay.
Most people probably haven't.
I also haven't read all of Lord of the Rings either. But that said, you know, when we talk about the learnings, how much of that did you find that you practiced day to day at Google?
In cloud, I mostly worked in cloud sales. So we were kind of post sales, the experts from the technology side, kind of bridged engineering and sales. So I didn't get to like interact with the SREs directly, but we definitely encouraged and had to learn the principles so that we could share them with our customers. And so everyone wanted to do things like Google did, you know, oh, these SREs are there and to the rescue and they have amazing skills. And they did. And they were very special at Google to operate Google's what I would call alien technology. And so, you know, from a principal's point of view, it was actually kind of reminded me a lot of what I learned at JPL, you know, from redundant systems and automating everything, having the correct level of monitoring. The tools that I encountered at Google were incredible. The level of detail you could get very quickly, everything was kind of at your fingertips. So I saw the SREs being very productive when there was an outage. Things were communicated really well, and everyone just kind of knew what they were doing. And that was really inspiring, for one, just to see like how everything came together. That's kind of what the best part of working at Google was just kind of seeing how the sausage was made. You know, I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting. It still had some of its big company problems. It wasn't all roses, but yeah, it was definitely a very interesting adventure.
So you went from Google, and did you go directly to the company that you helped start right now?
I did. I did. I made the jump directly. So while I was at Google, you know, not only seeing how SRE worked, but seeing how software was built in general by our customers and by Google really inspired me to build a new solution around remote productivity. And I've always been a big fan of containers since the birth of Docker and Kubernetes. And I built this solution that let you run kind of per user workloads on Kubernetes in containers. And this proved to be interesting because you could, you know, stand up your own little data processing system and scale it out to your team, as well as like build remote code editors or remote desktop experiences from containers. And I was very excited about this solution. The customers were really starting to adopt it. And as a solution architect, most of the stuff we built, we always open source it. So I put it on GitHub as a project called Selkies. And so Selkies is the Kubernetes components and is also the high-performance streaming to a web browser with WebRTC on GitHub. And a small company, Itopia, I met at a Google conference, they saw my talk and they love the technology. They were looking for something like that to help some of their product line. And they brought me in as VP of product. So they said, we wanted to productize this. And I'm like, well, you're not doing that without me, right? So through the pandemic and work from home and everything, I was like, you know, now's probably a good time to go try something new. This is going to be, and I get to keep working on my baby, which is Selkies. So yeah, I've been at Itopia since beginning of 2021, building a remote desktop, really just remote developer environments and other remote productivity tools for Itopia.
Well, and Dan, that's pretty exciting because you actually talked a little bit about that at DevOps Days Boise, which if that video is posted by the time of publication of this podcast, we'll put a link to that in the show notes. But you're also giving a talk about this at Scale 19x in July, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so Scale is the Southern California Linux Expo, and it's a conference I really enjoy going to. I get to see people from Southern California and other out of town. A lot of JPLers usually go as well and present. So it's a good time to reconnect with folks. But so Scale, you know, they usually want to talk more about Linux and some of the technologies and open source. And so, really looking forward to sharing more about Selkies and kind of how it came to be, how containers can be used for more than just web servers and microservices, but also, you know, maybe like streaming video games out of your container with a GPU attached. The DevOps Days Boise had a little demo of that. So hopefully that video gets attached. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that talk at the end of July.
Now I'm really disappointed that I missed your talk at DevOps Days Boise. So Julie, since that's your domain, please get those videos online quickly.
I am working on it. But Dan, one of the things that, you know, you talk about is that you are the primary maintainer on this and that you're looking to grow and improve with input from the community. So tell us, how can the community get involved with this?
Yeah, so Selkies is on GitHub. You can also get to it from selkies.io. And basically looking for people to try it out, run it to find problems, you know, battle test it. We've been running it in production at Itopia. It's powering the products I'm building now. So we are the primary maintainers. I only have a few others, but, you know, just trying to build more of an open source community and level up the number of contributors and folks that are using it and making it better. I think it's an interesting technology that has a lot of potential.
I think as we talk about reliability, one of the things that we haven't covered, and maybe it's time for us to actually dive into that with you, is reliability around open source. And particularly, I think one of the problems that always happens with open source projects like this is, you know, you're the sole maintainer, right? And how do you actually build a reliable community and start to grow this out? Like, what happens if Dan suddenly just decides to rage quit tech and ups and leaves and lives on his own little private island somewhere? What happens to Selkies? Do you have any advice for people who've really done this, right? They have a pet project, they put it on GitHub, it starts to gain some traction, but ultimately it's still sort of their project. Do you have any advice for how people can take that project and actually build a reliable, growing, thriving community around it?
Honestly, I'm still trying to figure that out myself. It's not easy. Having the right people on your team helps a lot, like having a developer advocate, developer relations to showcase what it's capable of in order to create interest around the project, I think is a big component of that. The license that you choose is also pretty important to that. You know, there's some software licenses that kind of force the open sourcing of any derivative of what you build. And so that can kind of keep it open as well as, you know, move it forward a little bit. So I think that's a component. And then, you know, just especially with conferences being not a thing in the last couple of years, it's been really hard to get the word out and generate buzz about some of these newer open source technologies. One of the things I kind of like really hope comes out of a 2-year heads down time for developers is that we're going to see some like crazy amazing tech on the other side. So I'm really looking forward to the conferences later this year as they're opening up more to see what people have been building. Yeah, very interested in that.
I think the conversation around open source licenses is one that's particularly interesting just because there's a lot involved there. And there's been some controversy over the past couple of years as very popular open source projects have decided to change licenses, thinking of things like Elastic and MongoDB and some other things.
Yeah, totally.
You chose for Selkies, it looks like it's Apache V2.
Yep. That was mostly from a Google legal point of view. When I was open sourcing it, everything had to be, you know, had to have the right license, and Apache was the one that we published things under. You know, open source projects change their license frequently. You saw that, like what you said, with Elastic and Mongo. And that's a delicate thing, you know, because you got to make sure you preserve the community. You can definitely alienate a lot of your community if you do it wrong. So you got to be careful. But you also, you know, as companies build this tech and they're proud of it, they want to turn it into a product. It's a very delicate process trying to productize open source. It can be really helpful because it can give confidence to your customers, meaning that like, hey, you're building this thing. If it goes away, it's okay. There's this open source piece of it. So it instills a little bit of confidence there, but it also gets a little tricky, you know, like what features are we adding that add value that people will still pay for versus what they can get for free, because free is great, but you know, it's community. And I think there are things that private companies can add. My philosophy is basically around packaging, right? If you can package up an open source product to make it more easier to consume, easier to deploy, easier to observe and manage, then, you know, that's a lot of value that the rest of the free community may not necessarily need, right? If they're just kind of kicking the tires, or if they have a very experienced Kubernetes team on site, they can run this thing by themselves, go for it, you know? But for those, the majority that may not have that, you know, companies can come in and repackage things to make it easier to run open source. I think there's a lot of value there.
So speaking of companies repackaging things, you mentioned that Itopia had really sort of acquired you in order to really build on top of Silkies. What are the folks at Itopia doing, and how are they leveraging the software?
Yeah, that's a good question. So Itopia's mission is to radically improve work from anywhere. And we do that by building software to orchestrate and automate access to remote computing. And that orchestration and automation is a key component to this like SaaS-like model for cloud computing. And so Silkies is a core piece of that technology. It's designed for orchestrating per user workloads, like remote environments that you would need to stand up. And so, you know, we're adding on things that make it more consumable for an enterprise, things like VPN peering and single sign-on. A lot of these things that enterprises need from day one in order to check all the boxes with their security teams. And at the heart of that is really just increasing the amount of the productivity you have through onboarding. Basically, you know, setting up a developer environment can take, you know, days or weeks to get all the dependencies set up. And the point of Itopia Spaces, the product I'm working on, is to reduce that amount of time as much as possible. And, you know, this can increase risk if you have a product that needs to get shipped and you're trying to grow or scale your company and team and they can't do that. You can slip deadlines and introduce problems, and having an environment that's not consistent introduces reliability problems, right? Because now you have developers, hey, it works on my machine, but, you know, they don't have the same machine, same environment as everyone else. And now when it comes to reproducing bugs or even fixing them, you can introduce more problems to the software supply chain.
I mean, that sounds like a great problem to solve, and I'm glad you're working on it. With your background being varied, starting as an intern to now where you personally are being acquired by organizations, what's something that you've really learned or taken from that? Because one thing that you said was that you failed your first Google interview badly. And yes. I find that interesting because it sounds like, you know, you've taken that learning from failure. You've embraced the fact that you failed it. Actually, I just kind of want to go back. Tell us, do you know what you did?
It was definitely a failure. I don't know how spectacular it was, but like, it was. Google interviews are hard. I mean, and that's just how it is. And it's notorious for that. And I didn't have enough of the core software experience at the time to pass the interview. There's usually like 5 interviews for a software engineer. And I made it through like 4 of them. And the last one was like just really, really, really hard. And I could not figure it out. Yeah, because this is like back in the day, and I think they still do this, like where you're like coding on a whiteboard, right? Like, okay, write the C code on a whiteboard and it has to work. You know, the dude's like right there compiling it, right? You're like, okay, well, boy. So it's not only is it high stress, but it has to be right as well. And so like it was just a very difficult experience. And what I learned from that was basically, okay, I need to, one, get more experience in this style and this domain of programming, as well as, you know, get more comfortable speaking and being in front of people I don't know. So yeah, there's definitely components there of personal growth as well as technical growth. From a technical point of view, like my philosophy with as being an engineer in general and software developer is have a really big toolbox and use the tools that are appropriate for the job. This is like one of my core philosophies. Like people ask, you know, what language do you use? And I'm like, whatever language the you needed to solve the problem. Like if you're writing software in a with libraries that are all written in C, then don't try to do that in like Java or something. It's some other language that doesn't have those language bindings. Don't reinvent the language bindings. You follow the problem and you follow the tech. What language? What tool will best solve this problem? I'm always working backwards from the problem and then bringing in the right tools to solve it. And that's something that has paid off in dividends, because now it's very problem solving is fun and something I always had a passion for. But when you have a toolbox that is full of interesting gadgets and things you can use. You get excited every time you get to use that tool. Like, just like power tools here, I have a home. It's like, yeah, I get to use the miter saw for this thing. Awesome. I don't have one. Okay, I'm going to go buy one.
You know? That's a really good point. One of the talks that I gave was you can't buy DevOps. And it was really all about letting developers be part of the process in choosing the tools that they're going to use. Because sometimes I think organizations put too many constraints around that and force you to use these tools that might not be the best for what you're trying to accomplish. So I like that you bring up having the ability to be excited about your toolbox or your miter saw. For me, it would be my Dremel. Right. But what tool is going to, they really are. What tool is going to be best for the job that you are trying to accomplish? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big thing. So when you look to bring people onto your team, what kind of questions do you ask them? What are you looking for?
Well, we're just now starting to really grow the company and try and scale it up. And so we're starting to get into more interview stuff. I try to tell myself I don't want to put someone through the Google experience again. And part of that's just because it wasn't pleasant, but also like I don't know if it was really that useful at the end of the day. And so, you know, there's a lot about culture fit that is really important. People have to be able to communicate and feel comfortable with your team and the pace that your team is working at. And so that's really important. But, you know, technically, you know, I like to see a lot of, you know, you got to be able to show me that you can solve problems. That it can be from, just works that you've done in open source. You know, having a good resume of projects you've worked on is really important, because then we can just talk about tech and stories about how you solve the problem. I don't need you to go to the whiteboard and code me something because you have like 30 repos on GitHub or something, right? And so the questions are much more around problem solving. You know, how would you solve this problem? What technology choices would you use and why? Sometimes I'll get to fundamentals, like, do you understand how this database works at its core or not? You know, or why is that good or bad? And so looking for people who can really think within the toolbox they have. It doesn't have to be a big one, but do they know how to use the tools that they've acquired so far? And really just like really critically think through problems. So to me, that's a better skill to have than just, you know, being able to write code on a whiteboard.
Thanks for that, Dan. And earlier, before we started the official recording here, you were talking a little bit about time drift. Do you want to fill everybody in on what you were talking about? Because I don't think it was Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness.
No, I think we were talking about
clock skew.
Daylight savings time.
Yeah.
Clock skew, clock drift. There was a time at JPL when we were inserting a leap second to the time. This actually happened all throughout the world, where periodically the clocks will drift far enough because the orbits and the rotation of the planet are not perfectly aligned to 365 days in a year and 24 hours in a day. And so every so decades, you have to insert these leap seconds in order to catch up and make time more precise. Well, space travel, when you're planning, you're planning to the position of the stars and the planets and the orbital bodies. And those measurements are done at such a large scale that your precision goes like way out, you know, many, many decimal places in order to properly plan to the bodies that big. And with the Mars rover, one of these leap seconds happened to come in like right before we launched. And it was like, oh my gosh, we had to change all of our ephemeris files, the data that used to track positions. And we had to do it, like synchronize it all like right when the leap second was going in. And we tested this extensively. But because if you get it wrong, your spacecraft is traveling like 15,000 miles an hour towards Mars. And a 1 second pointing error from Earth means like you miss the whole planet. You won't even get there. We're not talking about like missing the landing site of like a few kilometers. No, it's like thousands of kilometers in pointing error. So things are astronomical in units. Actually, that's why they're called AUs, astronomical units, when you're measuring the distance from the sun. So yeah, it was a pretty fun time, a little bit nerve wracking, just because the number of systems that had to be updated and changed at the same time. It's kind of like doing a rolling update on a on a piece of software that just had to go out all at the same time. Yeah.
I think that's really interesting, particularly because, you know, for most of us, I think as we build things, whether that's locally or in the cloud or wherever our servers are at, we're so used to things like NTP, right? Where things just automatically sync and I don't have to really think about it. And I don't really have to worry about the accuracy because NTP stays pretty tight, usually, generally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm imagining, obviously, like on a spacecraft flying 15,000 miles a second or whatever, no NTP out there.
Yeah, no NTP and no GPS. Like all the things you take for granted on Mars are just not there. And Mars even has a different time system altogether. Like the days on Mars are about 40 minutes longer because the planet spins slower. And my first 90 sols or days on Mars of the mission, the entire planning team on Earth that I was a part of, we lived on Mars time. So we had to synchronize our Earth schedule with what the rover was doing so that when the rover was asleep, we were planning the next day's activities. And when it woke up, it was ready to go and do work during the day. And so we did this Mars time thing for 90 days. That was mostly inherited from the Mars exploration rover Spirit and Opportunity, because they were only designed to live for like 90 days. So the whole team shifted. And now it's kind of done in spirit of that mission. Our rover, we knew, was going to last a little bit longer. But just in case, let's shift everyone to Mars time and see what happened. It was not good. We had to end that after 90 days. People, your brain just gets completely fried after that. But it was bizarre. And then there's no time. You have to invent your own time system for Mars. Like there's no, it was called LMST, or local Mars standard time, local mean standard time. But it was all like relative to, you know, the equator and where you were on the planet. And so Mars had its own Mars time that counted at a different rate per second. And so it was funny, we had these clocks in the mission control room that it was this giant TV screen that had like four different time clocks running. It had like Pasadena time, UTC time, Mars time, and like whatever time it was at the space network. And I was like, oh my gosh. And so we're always doing these like time conversions in our heads. It was mental. So can we just all be on UTC time?
So I'm curious, with that time shift of being on Mars time and 40 minutes longer, that inherently means that by the end of that 90 days, like suddenly your 8 a.m. Mars local time is like shifted and is now like hours off, right? You're waking up, yeah, in the middle of the night.
Totally. Wow. Yeah. Within like 2 weeks, your schedule will be like upside down. Because you're like every day you're coming in 40 minutes later. And yeah, it was brutal. I don't know. Humans are not supposed to do that. If you're actually living on Mars, you're probably okay. But like trying to synchronize those schedules, I thought going from East Coast to West Coast time working remote was hard. Like that's really remote.
Dan, that's just astronomical. I'm so sorry. I had to do it. But with that.
Thanks, Julie.
With that, Dan, I really just want to thank you for your time on Break Things on Purpose with us today. And as promised, if I can find the links to Dan's talks, if they're available before this episode posts, we will put those in the show notes. Otherwise, we'll put the link to the YouTube channel in the show notes to check for updates. And with that, I just want to thank you, Dan, and wish you a wonderful day.
Before we go, Dan, do you have anything that you would like to plug? Any projects that people should check out, where they can find you on the internet, stuff like that?
Yeah, thank you guys very much for having me. It was a great conversation. Really enjoyed it. Please check out our new product, Itopia Spaces Remote Developer Environments, delivered powered by Selkies. We launched it last fall, and we're really trying to ramp that up. And then check out this open source Selkies project, selkies.io. We'll get you there. And yeah, we're looking for contributors. Beyond there, you can also find me on Twitter. I'm at Dan Isla, or on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for being a part of the show. It's been fantastic.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
For links to all the information mentioned, visit our website at gremlin.com/podcast. If you like this episode, subscribe to the Break Things on Purpose podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your favorite podcast platform. Our theme song is called Battle of Pogs by Komaku and is available on loyaltyfreakmusic.com. We'll be right back.